Welcome to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher. Perhaps no area of medicine has changed more dramatically than the field of medical ethics. It only came into existence in the wake of World War II because of the Nuremberg trials that included the Nazi doctors who conducted horrifying experiments on concentration camp inmates without their consent. Early medical ethics condoned paternalism by the nearly all-male physician corps. Paternal, Marcus Welby-type doctors knew what was best for their patients and sought to do so without soliciting their patients' input much of the time. Often, truth-telling was forsaken so as not to take away hope from patients. My guest today, Dr. Baron Lerner, is the author of a new memoir that traces the transition and growth of medical ethics from the era of his father, a paternalistic specialist in infectious diseases, to the modern era when paternalism is not just frowned upon, but is considered unethical. Lerner, the author of several books, is both a practicing internist at Bellevue Hospital in New York City and a historian and bioethicist at New York University. His new book, The Good Doctor, A Father, A Son, and the Evolution of Medical Ethics, is just out from Beacon Press. I spoke with him from a stop on his book tour. Baron Lerner, welcome to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm so glad to have you on the program. I guess I want to start by asking you, you know, your father, Dr. Phil Lerner, was a specialist in infectious diseases and consulted on patients at several hospitals in Cleveland, Ohio. And he was a beloved teacher at Case Western Reserve University School of Medicine for decades, where he actually became one of my own teachers. And he was a different kind of doctor than we see today among our trainees and even ourselves. And I guess I want to start by asking, what was so special about the way your father practiced?
Well, he's, I guess, what we might call in modern jargon, was a 24/7 doctor. He believed fervently that the patient and the patient's care was primary. So that meant either when he was in the hospital or when he was at home or when we were on vacation, he was constantly thinking about his patients, was often in touch when we were away with covering doctors, and just wanted to make sure that everything was being done for them that was possible. So he really immersed himself not only in the scientific literature, which he knew extremely well, but also in his patients' lives, and he tried to spend as much time as he could learning about who they were, what their values were, and then try to use that to get them to make the best decisions about their medical care.
And I think you mentioned in the book that he kept up with at least a dozen different journals that he kind of read religiously, and of course a lot of these habits certainly started well before the internet. So were these things he piled up around the house or kept in the office? And I mean, it just seemed like he really did have an encyclopedic knowledge of sort of all things bacterial and viral.
I think my mother would corroborate that he kept them lying around the house. He had all these journals. They came to the house largely, and he read them, and then he never threw anything out. So they piled up in lots of places. Back in the old days, doctors used to take the journals after a year and bind them. So a lot of the books in the walls of our house were bound journals. And right before the internet, that was his auxiliary brain. So he and doctors from that era, I think, would say, oh my God, I remember that article from so-and-so in the 1950s about three cases of tularemia, and I'm going to go find that. And he would go hunting around in his stacks of papers or in his journal, bound journals, and look for that article. So that was very much what the house looked like. And that was the way he felt medicine needed to be practiced, that you had to have this encyclopedic knowledge of all these areas so you could do your absolute best to make the right diagnosis.
Your father himself started keeping his own journal in the 1970s, which really became the basis for this book. What led him to start journaling, do you think?
Well, there were two things. He actually had kept journals earlier on my birthday and my sister's birthday. So it actually started sort of as a family chronicle when he would say what we had done during that previous year and then what vacation we went on and how my sister and I were growing up. But then in the 1970s, when it was actually 1977, my grandfather died unexpectedly, my dad's father, and my mother got breast cancer. And my dad started at that point to write spontaneously, often on yellow legal pads, just his feelings and thoughts about what was going on in his life. And that was where I found all these interesting medical details about his cases, about illnesses in our family, and about his thoughts on medicine and how medicine was changing. So it was an incredibly rich set of materials for me to work with.
And you make clear that he willingly shared these with you. and I guess maybe hoping you would carry on the family chronicle, or do you think he had other aspirations for sharing his journals with you?
I don't know. I think he was proud of me as a writer and as a historian and felt that I would do a good job with this. As I chronicle throughout the book, he and I butted heads over a lot of issues, particularly surrounding medical ethics. So I think he knew that he was not going to be portrayed as an angel in the book, and that there were going to be certain behaviors that he had done and that he had written about that I was going to be critical of. But I appreciated the fact that despite that, he really trusted me and was willing to give me access to all of this and actually encourage me to write the book.
So your book, The Good Doctor, is what it's called, A Father, A Son, and the Evolution of Medical Ethics, encompasses not only both you and your father's growth and development as doctors, but places both of you in the context of a sea change in medical ethics. So can you describe for us what is meant or what you mean by the age of paternalism?
Yeah, the age of paternalism, I think most people focus on the post-World War II years as sort of the apogee of paternalism in American medicine. And at that time, medicine had made a lot of remarkable advances. So there were antibiotics for the first time, things like the sulfa drugs and penicillin. There was the polio vaccine. There was blood banking. And all of a sudden, you could save lives that had previously been lost. And as a result, the esteem of the medical profession, which had actually not been so hot in the 19th century and the early 20th century, sort of went through the roof. And accompanying that new ability of medicine to make these cures was a belief among doctors that they really should rule the roost. I mean, if they had all these powerful tools at their hands, why wouldn't they be the ones to employ them and make all the decisions? And what wound up happening was that doctors became comfortable, at times misleading patients and not even telling them all of what was going on in their zeal to get patients to do what they thought the right thing was. The most blatant example of this that a lot of people have talked about is the concealment of cancer diagnoses. So it was totally commonplace in these years when patients had cancer that the doctors would tell their families but lie to the patients. And again, the idea was, let's not tell them the really bad news. Let's do what we can for them, and that's going to be the best therapeutic option for these folks. So that was really what paternalism was all about. It can be encompassed in a three-word phrase, which was, doctor knows best.
So what led to the demise of paternalism?
Well, I focus on that with respect to social changes in American society. So if you think about the 60s and 70s in particular, you have the civil rights movement, you have the protests against the Vietnam War, you have feminism, and these sorts of social movements, which all questioned authority and questioned the status quo in America, very much became part of medicine. So in the 70s, you get, for example, the Boston Women's Health Collective that starts advocating that women during childbirth assert their rights. You get women that I talked about in my breast cancer book insisting that doctors tell them all the options for the treatment of breast cancer. And then, finally, you get a bunch of scandals in the world of medicine, the best known of which, of course, was Tuskegee, in which doctors were letting poor African-American men with syphilis be untreated so they could study the disease. And all of this added up to a new assessment of American medicine that questioned the authority of doctors and that saw doctors often as either patronizing or even arrogant in their zeal to control the entire situation and to tell patients what to do. And that's why the change happened. So this is where the bioethics movement sort of rushes in and takes charge and assumes a lot of authority itself. And you start to see the concepts that we're now so familiar with, like patient autonomy and patients' rights and informed consent.
So if we think of medical ethics as a pendulum between paternalism and patient autonomy, where do you think the pendulum sits today? And you outline in the book something called shared decision-making. And I wonder, you know, how would your father have handled the notion of shared decision-making?
Well, shared decision-making gets at the idea of doctors and patients working together to come up with solutions. Basically, where doctors sort of guide patients and then the patients make the decisions. My dad, as his career moved along, did not have his head in the sand, and he understood that times were changing. So he grew somewhat more comfortable empowering patients to participate in their decisions in the sort of way that shared decision-making suggests it should be. You know, I think we've moved away from a strict autonomy approach. I think sometimes there's such a backlash to something that's happened in the past, we go a little bit too far. So I think certainly in the case of autonomy, there was such a revulsion, in a sense, to the excesses of paternalism that we pushed all the way over to autonomy, and now we're sort of gradually moving back a little bit. And I tried in the book to suggest some ways that approaches that seem more paternalistic and harken back to my dad's era can still potentially have a place in a medical system that insists on informed consent. It's sometimes a hard marriage, but I think patients do want doctors to give advice at times, and I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing.
Yeah, if your own patients, or I guess my own patients, will say, okay, you've explained everything, what would you do, doc?
Yeah, I hear that all the time, and I would say most of the time I answer the question and give an opinion, but I'm also very careful to remind them that they are the patient and I'm not the patient, so they need to recall what I said about the other options as well.
So getting back to your father, one of the things that you were surprised to learn in your research for the book was that he had participated in something we would certainly now consider to be unethical, a type of research that took place at the Wrentham State School. Could you outline what happened there and what his involvement was?
My dad, when he was an infectious diseases fellow, participated in experiments at this school outside of Boston, which housed mostly boys, I think, who had issues of some degree of mental disability or behavioral problems. They were in the institution, and the doctors that my dad and his fellow doctors went to the institution got permission from the superintendent to inject antibiotics into the patients, and these guys, they weren't patients, into the subjects, and they were not sick at all. They didn't need antibiotics, and then draw blood tests and urine tests on these boys to understand how the antibiotics were metabolized in the system. So this was pure experimentation. There was no benefit at all to the subjects. And the doctors felt that they had the right, in a sense, to go in and do that because this was for the good of society more broadly. And so what happened here, as happened in many cases, Tuskegee that I mentioned before, and so many experiments during this era, was that a vulnerable population was used as a means to an end. And that sort of thing, we believe today, certainly is unethical, and even at the time, there were lots of people saying that you shouldn't be doing that.
Do you think your father had misgivings about being involved in that research, or only as times and mores changed did he come to see that it was unethical?
What he said to me when I brought this up to him was, he said, yeah, you couldn't get away with that today. So he didn't have the complete apology that I guess I'd hoped he had. But as a historian, I sort of understood that. I mean, he was doing what was accepted at the time, largely. And frankly, the sort of experiments they were doing there, thankfully, were not the ones that were actually really probably harming these boys in any way. So in a sense, my dad was a creature of his era, which many of us are. And certainly by the 1990s, when he and I were talking about this, I do remember him also saying, you know, that's just something that would never go on these days, and times have changed. So he did understand that there had been progress in respecting the rights of people in that sort of situation.
The book opens and later revisits a pivotal scene that you use in the narrative, which involves your father rather brusquely resisting the attempt to resuscitate an elderly patient, a hospitalized elderly patient who has, you know, horrible medical problems, who's been hospitalized for a number of weeks, and the patient is found to have no pulse. And so by protocol, I don't recall whether specifically it was a doctor or a nurse, somebody says, well, we have to activate the code team and try to resuscitate this patient. And your father had very strong views to the contrary. Can you describe what he was thinking and what the ethics of both that time and, I mean, it's not that long ago, really, and how we would think about that now, and perhaps how did your father explain himself in that situation?
Yeah, this was certainly the most jarring story, I think, in the book. And as you described, He basically had been following this woman for months in the hospital. She was completely bedbound. She hadn't walked in years. She had end-stage arthritis and vascular disease. And as I describe in the book, was miserable. She was in agony and pain all the time from ulcers and infections. And my dad had been following her daily. She was not a do-not-resuscitate case, but he felt 100% that it was appropriate for her, if her heart stopped, not to restart it, and it was would be her body saying, it's time for you to die. And indeed, when the team got there, she had just died. Her body was still warm, but her heart was not beating, and my dad did just what you said. He placed his body over hers and fought off the people trying to resuscitate her. So this was really the climax, in a sense, of that paternalistic mindset that we've been talking about. He felt sure there were rules and regulations in which technically this patient should have had CPR, but as a doctor, how could he tolerate this happening? All that would have happened probably was that her ribs would have been broken, and at the very best, she would have gone on a ventilator, unconscious, to the ICU, where she would have died. And he knew this woman, and he felt she was his patient, and he felt he knew her case, and he knew her so intimately that he was doing the right thing. So it's an extraordinarily powerful story about how one doctor's ethics conflicted with the standard ethics of the era. And that's what I play with in the book. My initial response to this was revulsion that he would play God so blatantly. But as I went through more and more of his journals and read more and more, I could at least understand the courage and the intense feelings that had led him to do something so dramatic.
And, you know, he didn't really have the... He had his own framework, to be sure. But when I read the book, I mean, he really struck me as a hero. Because here he was... First of all, I was so pleasantly surprised upon reading the book that I knew your father, and he really was a great teacher. I mean, he was just so animated and had so many great stories and patient anecdotes and vignettes to share. So here it seemed as though he was courageous, and he was doing what, you know, arguably was the right thing. I mean, certainly he didn't follow regulations or protocol. You know, there are those out there who would totally disagree with what he did, since the patient or her surrogate decision maker had not declared any wish for a do not resuscitate order. But it just seemed in some ways like he was a throwback to the age of strong paternalism, and yet in some ways he was, you know, presaging the whole, you know, palliative care and hospice movement that really strives to try to achieve, you know, comfort at the end of life and death with dignity. And so it's hard because, well, first, and he's your father, so, and you were very steeped in the history and the medical ethics, and so I understood your reaction too. But it was such a fascinating narrative of, again, what seemed heroic to me, and on the other hand, you know, you in the more modern educational model being kind of horrified at what your father had done.
Yeah, that conveys it well. I mean, that's I think why it was such a complicated story. And I mean, I don't think I used the word hero.
No, that's my
word. I think I said courageous once, maybe. Look, I struggled with it. The concern, of course, is that he was both hearkening back to the bad days of paternalism when doctors did whatever they wanted. But I think you're right also that he was able to see how, in its zeal to protect patients' rights and incorporate things like DNR laws, medicine had gone too far, I think, in honoring the wishes of people to prolong life. Now, this woman hadn't stated one way or the other, but this was the sort of patient, I think, that we often still see, where either the patient or the family says, do everything. And we as doctors know that it's inappropriate and quite frankly, inhumane, and we're stuck. And so I know, in fact, my dad was thrilled at the palliative care movement and the medical fertility movement and anything that was coming along the pike in medicine, not merely because they potentially restored the power of doctors, but because they were getting these complicated issues about life and death out there in a thoughtful way that patients could really do the right thing, and there was none of this prolongation of death, really, which my dad had begun to see so much.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm John Schumann, sitting in today for Rich Fisher. Our guest is Baron Lerner, a physician, historian, and professor at New York University School of Medicine. He's the author of the new book, The Good Doctor, A Father, A Son, and the Evolution of Medical Ethics, published by Beacon Press, a really fascinating memoir of his father and himself, yourself, Baron Lerner. In the book, you share some amazing medical cases that your father was involved in, and one such case was with a patient you call Laura. What made her case so unusual?
Laura was a, it's not her real name, Laura was a woman that my dad followed for years and years and years. She had a complicated immunodeficiency situation, which later became leukemia. And he got to know her so incredibly well because she had infection after infection. And so he became, in a sense, almost like her primary doctor. He knew her as well as her hematologist or anyone else that was following her. And when she was doing well, he was in a good mood. When she was doing poorly, he was in a bad mood. That's how much it impacted his life and indirectly our lives. At the end of her life, among the other things, by the way, that he did with Laura was come up with all sorts of experimental treatments based on his consultations with doctors across the country to try to get her better treatment for this very mysterious disease. At the end of her life, though, she finally had leukemia everywhere and came back into the hospital with yet another infection. She probably had hundreds of infections. And my dad decided that rather than trying to treat her pneumonia one more time, he was just going to give her morphine. And he made that decision unilaterally, again, displaying his penchant for paternalism. But he felt, again, knowing this person so well, what was the point in asking her about this treatment of pneumonia that might have prolonged her life in pain for a matter of days? It seemed absurd to him to ask the woman or her husband, and he just did what he felt was right as a doctor.
The latter portion of the book centers around your father's ministrations to several family members, which you describe as ethically problematic. And I guess I wonder if you would explain what was so challenging about it and how your own feelings come into play as he cared for, your grandmother, so his mother-in-law, and an aunt. And, what's problematic about a physician caring for his or her own family members? And then, spoiler alert, you wind up having to play the same role for your father.
Yeah, life is complicated. he really, another place I think where my dad crossed the line was in his care of family members. Now, this is something that was much more common back in the old days, before sort of all these ethical precepts. And doctors did get involved with treating family members to some degree. But by the 1990s, when my dad got very actively involved in caring for my grandmothers, for example, it was largely thought this was a bad idea. It's just too fraught with conflict of interest, right? You've got, on the one hand, you're the doctor, and on the other hand, you're the loving family member. And you really can get pulled in too many different directions if you're trying to balance those sorts of things. But my dad took it upon himself, and I'll focus on both my grandmothers, to get intimately involved in their care. And when both of them deteriorated with different sorts of situations, he advocated strongly. They were both in the hospital and was trying to get the staff to go up on their morphine and really end their pain and suffering. And I was and remain uncomfortable with what he was doing, even though there's part of me that says he knew both my grandmothers so well and what they did or didn't want that, in a sense, it was appropriate for him to be doing this. But I don't think anybody these days could advocate that sort of involvement of a family member. And indeed, you know, I think he only got away with this because he was such a senior doctor and so revered. I think if any family member these days tried to do that, they'd be slapped back appropriately by either the staff or by an ethics committee. So again, these are stories about doctoring in its most intense manifestation. If you say that your right to be a doctor and make decisions stems from you knowing your patients, well, there's no patients you know better than your family members. But this is hardly something I could ever advocate. Having said that, I did get thrown in at the end of my dad's life in having to make decisions for him. And the short version there is that he had developed Parkinson's and was quite end stage and was in a nursing home and was alert at times and could converse and make decisions for himself, but largely led a very, very poor quality of life. He was asleep much of the time, very drowsy, had difficulty maintaining a conversation, sometimes didn't know who people were. So he was very, very sort of end stage and getting worse. And I was forced to get involved in making decisions for him about how aggressive we were going to be.
What changed for your father near the end of his life? I mean, it was really shocking in the sense that he'd spent so much of his career both caring for patients and family members and paternalistically determining their own quality of life and vowing never to want to live that way. And yet, here he was afflicted with very advanced Parkinson's and saying quite the opposite.
Yeah, he surprised me. And part of me thinks maybe I waited too long to have some of these discussions with him, but the truth of the matter is, when I asked him when he was in the nursing home if he'd want to, for example, go back to the hospital and get intravenous antibiotics if he got an infection, he said yes, if we thought it was going to help. And I even asked would he go on a ventilator and go into an ICU, and he said yes to that also. Which was entirely 100% the opposite of what I thought he was going to say and what he would have said, I think, if he had been confronted with this exact sort of case during his career. And it was a humbling experience, and people in the world of ethics have written about these sorts of situations where people seemingly change their minds, and they are about as complicated as any situation you could imagine, and you really have to deal with them, I think, on a case-by-case basis. In my dad's case, I spoke to my mom and my sister and my uncle and all sorts of other folks, and we decided that based on who he had been and what he had believed in for so many years, treating any sort of infection aggressively was really not appropriate in his case. And to make a long story short, he eventually got sick in the nursing home, and he wound up getting supportive care and eventually died.
Well, Baron Lerner, congratulations on writing such a powerful memoir. The name of the new book is The Good Doctor, A Father, A Son, and the Evolution of Medical Ethics, just out from Beacon Press. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, John.
Baron Lerner is a physician, historian, and professor at New York University School of Medicine. His new book is called The Good Doctor, A Father, A Son, and the Evolution of Medical Ethics. It's published by Beacon Press. Well, that's Studio Tulsa on Health for today. Our show is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.